Ms. Boynes, would you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, 5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay. And you may begin whenever you're set.
May it please the Court, my name is Heather Barnes. I represent the Office of the Public Defender for the City of Newport News and Ms. Alicia Langan. The issue here today is sufficiency of the evidence for a probation violation. And although the standard for that is abuse of discretion, even at such a deferential standard, there is no evidence of a violation in this case. The major violation report did not allege, neither did the probation officer's testimony, that Ms. Langan missed a payment. According to the original sentencing order, she was ordered to make restitution payments during her period of 2 years of supervised probation to be monitored by the probation department. In the major violation report, probation says that they were responsible for setting the amount of her monthly restitution payments. And there's no allegation in that she missed any of those payments, although the amount did change, taking into account her changing financial situation. That's the only reason in
that. Here we're looking at your assignment of error. First, I have a question about it, because it says there was no requirement restitution be paid within 2 years.
Yes.
That's why there's error. But isn't that basic premise in your assignment of error wrong? Because there was no requirement that all of $47,000 be paid within 2 years. The major violation report was because, approximately only 2%, if that much, had been paid in 2 years. So at that rate, it would require over 50 years for her stepmother to be repaid.
Well,
restitution.
I don't.
So why is your assignment of error not accurate?
I believe it is accurate. If you read the bottom of the major violation report, it says that she was ending her 2 year period of supervised probation, and she still owed $46,000. If the probation department was unhappy with the total amount paid during that 2 year period, but that's not Ms. Langan's responsibility, because they were the ones who were setting her monthly payment amount, and she was meeting
those. That was set, like, the order was in March 21st or so, or 26th of 2014, and then she signed what she was going to do on April 1st, 2014. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that second date. I know the March 21st date was the date that she was found guilty. I would have to double check the major violation report to see which day she signed her conditions.
After that she signed what she was supposed to do, right?
Certainly.
With the probation officer.
And she was doing that. There's no allegation that she ever missed a payment. The only discrepancy in the total amount, which would be that when she made a payment, the clerk's office mistakenly credited it towards court costs instead of her restitution, but that she was making her monthly payments as required by her probation officer.
Is it, you don't disagree with the fact that originally it was set for $75 per month, right?
I believe that's what she said in her testimony. However, in the major violation report, I believe it said 80. Or
so
maybe the reverse was true.
Let's
there was a discrepancy there.
It was 75. And then at some point, it was reduced when she moved to Hampton down to 40.
Yes.
And so if the minimum payment was $40 a month, and there were 24 months involved here, even if you divide 930 by 24, you only get $38.50. So how could she have been paying the minimum every month if she didn't miss a payment or pay below the minimum that was required?
First would be,
even if you don't have a $75 payment in there.
I have a couple of responses to that. The first would be that the miscredited payments to her court costs would obviously lower her restitution total. However, she was still made a monthly payment, and thus I don't believe it'd be appropriate to find her in violation based on a mistake
even
by the clerk's office.
Even if she wasn't making the minimum payment due that she'd agreed to.
Yes, but as it notes in the major violation report, her first couple of payments had been miscredited, and so even though that takes a couple of months out. In addition, the major violation report was filed before her 2 years was up. It was filed at the beginning of March, and so 1 or 2 months worth of payments would be missing as well.
Even if she only made one $75 payment, and so you have 23 months, because, as you say, it's right before the end of March that the major violation report is done. Perhaps the 24th payment wasn't due yet. If you subtract 75, just one $75 payment from 930, and you divide by 23, you get $38.86. So, and this is all in the record, so...
Well, those total amounts were in the record, but there was no breakdowns. There was certainly no discussion of this, and there was no allegation on the part.
If the numbers are in the record, certainly we can, on appeal, can do basic math to find out whether $40 was paid every month.
Well, Your Honor, I think it would be a manifest injustice to Ms. Langan to create an allegation upon appeal that a payment was missed when no such allegation was made at the major violation report or by her probation officer or the Commonwealth attorney. There was no argument of that. Otherwise, we could have responded to it then.
Where I think the same premise. Without any violation of any sort, wouldn't the judge be able to alter his conditions of probation, and during the period of 2 years on which she was on probation, decide, I need to change the requirements and speed up the restitution? Wouldn't the judge be able to alter the terms under which the sentence is suspended without having to have had a violation?
I believe the judge does have the authority to change the repayment terms. The judge could have set different terms from the get-go. However, when it is filed as a violation of probation, Ms. Langan has the right to rely on what that major violation report says.
So to an extent, what was done in result was within the authority of the court. It's just the way it was done was improper because it would have put her down as having been a violator.
I think that had a motion to revoke a suspended sentence rather than a probation violation, had it been done through that mechanism, that would have been different. But as this court has noted in Ward v. Commonwealth, 41 Virginia, App 496, 2003, there are severe consequences to a probation violation it's a criminal proceeding, and it has an effect on her criminal record, and it counts as a sentencing event.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. But couldn't the judge just have issued a show cause as to why your terms of probation shouldn't have been changed, and even though it had been a stellar person, just saying, I'm sorry, but we've got to do a little bit better on this restitution, and I'm going to require you to do the restitution. That could have been done that way, without the taint of a revocation.
Yes, I believe that was possible, but it wasn't done that way, and she now has an additional criminal conviction that is not supported by evidence in the record.
Because Judge Pugh didn't set the restitution payments to begin with. He simply left it to the probation officer, just part of how we've found ourselves in this spot. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I believe that's correct. The initial orders say that the supervised probation was to monitor her payments. The orders only list the total amount due. They do not contain a due date, and they do not contain a monthly payment amount requirement. And the major violation reports says that it was probation's responsibility to set the monthly payment amount.
And we don't have in the record just how much she had paid that got credited mistakenly as court costs instead of restitution. Is that right?
No, the major violation report did not include that information, neither did the testimony of the probation officer.
But what is in the record is that she had made payments ostensibly that were supposed to go towards restitution, but mistakenly got credited as court costs.
Yes, that is correct.
Why wouldn't appellant need to let us know, though, if you're saying error occurred below, why isn't it appellant's responsibility actually to let us know what went to court costs so that's clear on appeal if it's a significant factor in this matter?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that goes back to what the Attorney General noted, that it's not clear from the record what Judge Pugh's basis for this ruling was, that whether it was my argument that, as it seems from the probation violation report, that the issue was that the total amount is not paid by the time of her 2 years is up versus that they thought it was too slow. Either, I believe the first one is not supported by the order, as the original order has, that her indefinite good behavior is what is tied to the restitution. The supervised probation was in a different paragraph, and it is limited to 2 years and is to monitoring. I believe that contemplates the original order, shows that the judge knows that the $47,000 is not going to be paid in 2 years because he tied it to indefinite good behavior, not to 2 years of supervised probation. And so I believe that shows that she should be able to rely on that, even though it's a statutory construction. Expressio unius et exclusio alterius, I think, applies here because her order says that it was good behavior.
Can I take you to page 27 of the joint appendix? And this is when you're talking to the court and you say, yes, Your Honor, that according to the report, Ms. Langan was ordered to make monthly payments in agreement with her probation officer, that those payments were to be $40 a month. At the most recent time, she was making those. Why doesn't that imply that she wasn't always making them every month as she was supposed to do?
It just implies that she was originally making $75 payments. There is no allegation, again, that there was any missed payments, that simply her amount changed, and that was the only... That and the total amount were the only things in the major violation report. And
so we're not able to take into consideration that when you look at the total amount and you look at the total number of months that she was supposed to be paying restitution, that it ends up to be being less than $40, and that was what she'd agreed upon. It's my understanding, you're saying with the probation officer at a minimum, even when she moved to Hampton, when it was reduced to $40 a month from 75 or 80, whatever it was, and I'm going with 75 here to make it easier for her. Why we can't take into consideration the fact that when you look at the total number of months and the total amount of payments, that it's less than even the 40 per month?
As I stated before, Your Honor, I believe that there's a couple months missing due to the timing of her start of probation and when the revocation was filed, those months when her payments were miscredited. And again, if there was a month where she missed a payment, it would be the responsibility of the probation officer or the Commonwealth to bring that before the court and to put it in the major violation report so that we would be on notice that there was a month when a payment was missed. And that,
so
that
should have been a major
violation
report a lot earlier than it was, is
or,
what you're arguing.
Or if there was a missed payment, then that information should have been included so that we could have researched it, found out what happened, presented evidence about it in a circuit court. But they simply never alleged that she missed a payment. And thus, that's why there is a pockety of evidence in the record about that, because they never alleged it, so we never defended against it.
And your client isn't going to know how things are credited. She goes to the window, she makes a payment, she's given a receipt for a payment. She has no idea whether they properly credit towards restitution or court costs. Is that a fair statement?
I believe that would be fair, Your Honor. Certainly, if you know that error might have been brought to her attention and then that issue was fixed, as indicated in the major violation report. But I don't think the court goes back and moves the money around.
Do you want to save your last couple of minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mrs. Fitzgerald.
Good morning, mate. Your Honors, may it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, here on behalf of the Commonwealth this morning. The record in this case fairly supports the trial court's actions, and that is what this court has to determine on appeal. And the court is permitted, as Judge Beals noted, to look at that major violation report, to look at those numbers and do the simple math. And the trial court could certainly have done that as well. The trial court opened...
Now, getting to that, let's say we do that simple math. We shield our eyes from what is in the record, and that's that a couple of payments were miscredited towards court costs instead of restitution, and come to that $38 a month figure. $38 versus $40 a month, when both of them are not even drops in the bucket to get to a $47,000 restitution obligation. How did we determine that $38 versus $40 is unreasonable?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court was certainly entitled to reach that conclusion if the defendant was not making the payments as ordered by the probation officer in this case and looking at the totality of the restitution paid versus not paid.
Did the trial court ever say that it found anything to be unreasonable? I don't know that Judge Pugh ever even said that I find you in violation. He just mentioned that you got a big restitution figure. You can't ignore it.
It is a short record, Your Honor. However, the deficiencies in the record regarding what the trial court ruled do not prejudice the Commonwealth on appeal. It is the defendant's burden to make sure the court's ruling is articulated, and if the defendant has an objection with that, it is the defendant's burden to make sure that the record in this case comes before the court. And to the extent it's not clear what the judge ruled, and to the extent that that is exacerbated by the fact that final orders in this case show that the defendant stipulated the sufficiency of the evidence, that paucity of rationale does not prejudice the Commonwealth on appeal. The burden is on the defendant to make the trial court's ruling clear in this matter.
You simply can't determine from this record that there was unreasonable failure to pay restitution.
Correct, Your Honor. However, the record does support the defendant was not making the restitution payments, as we've said through that math. However, I think it's significant in this case to note that the trial court did not impose a term of imprisonment. The trial court did not revoke and just flat revoke these sentences. And that's what the court's talked about in Duff, and what the statute contemplates is that only unreasonable failure to pay restitution results in revocation, results in jail time. In this case, the trial court did not impose any active jail time. Probation did not recommend any active jail time. And the court perhaps did take into account that note in reading the record and looking at the major violation report that some of these payments might have gone to restitution. The trial court may have taken into account that the defendant was ill and that she's moved multiple times. However, the failure to pay restitution is there, and the trial court's determination that she doesn't go to prison for that, that we just put her on a new payment plan, we give her more time, does fairly balance the court's dual prerogatives there, which is to get this woman her money back and also to rehabilitate the defendant.
What, if any, months does it reflect that the defendant failed to pay restitution?
Your Honor, I would submit that you have to go based on the numbers and break down the math yourself. And that
which
is
then,
the
again,
record.
Ignores what was credited as court costs instead of restitution.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think the defendant's job, that there is no evidence of that in the record other than that note, which doesn't say how much or what. And if the defendant wanted to rely on that defense at trial to combat the prima facie evidence in the record of a violation, the defendant could have raised that.
How, from a practical standpoint, is the defendant supposed to know that?
Well, Your Honor, the defendant is represented by counsel in this matter, and counsel could have looked at that probation report the same way the judge looked at it, the same way the Commonwealth looked at it, and tried to determine what.
The probation report didn't talk about that. That was a note in the court's file.
I'm sorry, I believe the probation report does note that some of the payments have gone to restitution.
Okay.
Yes, it's on page 10 of the joint appendix. So to the extent that those numbers were influenced by that in any way, it would be on the defendant to assert that as an affirmative defense. This is much like the Kelsia case where the court held that once the Commonwealth proves a non-payment, the burden shifts to the defendant to show an inability to pay. In this case, whether those payments were going other places is similar to an inability to pay. And so the defendant would have had the burden at this proceeding to come forward with evidence as to why these payments were not credited.
Except
properly.
Doesn't the major violation report come forward with some of that evidence, that they were miscredited? And if we're talking about a difference of $2 a month, then how does that not help the defendant?
Your Honor, I think looking at that probation report and at this point on appeal, you have to take the evidence in the light most favorable to Commonwealth, and we have to draw reasonable inferences from those credible facts. And I think the reasonable inference from those numbers, even including that note regarding her court costs, which she was also ordered to pay. It's not like she was paying extra money and it wasn't benefiting her. She was ordered to pay court costs as well as restitution.
But we all know that the payments go first towards restitution, and once restitution is satisfied, they go towards court costs.
Yes, Your Honor. And if the defendant had presented information to this court regarding the misappropriation of those payments, had presented that to the trial court in this case, then we might be in a different position on appeal. However, the record before this court as it is sufficient to support the trial court's determination in this case. Probation revocations are not beyond reasonable doubt. We're looking at a proceeding.
Whose responsibility on appeal is it to show where the court costs went, if it was some of it went to court costs?
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the trial court may not have been aware that some of these went to court costs, it's the defendant's job at trial to bring that forward to the trial court. And the defense notably does not argue on brief that that was a reason that the trial court erred in this case. However, if they had, I would have responded that it was waived by not bringing it to the court's attention below. We've obviously addressed the court cost issue out of candor to this tribunal. However, it was not raised by the defense either below or on appeal. I'm here today. So to the extent the trial court was maybe not aware of that or did not take it into account, then that certainly would be something the defense needs to raise in the first instance below.
But we're to presume that the trial court was aware of it when it's in the major violation report that was admitted into the evidence, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. However, the trial court may not have been aware the defendant wasn't trying to rely on that as a defense in this matter. The trial court also, again, may have looked at the totality of this restitution amount, noted that, and again, we're assuming, as we have to, because the record is somewhat short, you know, we're looking at $40 payments. Some of those payments were not $40. Some of those payments were $75 or even $80 in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth if you take the higher of those two numbers. So we're making some period of $80 payments over a two-year period plus some $40 payments, and we still don't get to $24 payments of court costs. I think that's plain on this record, and if the defense wants to argue that those payments have been misappropriated, that's an argument that needs to be made at the trial court in the first instance. It's not an argument that we can take into account here on appeal.
What specifically does the major violation report allege how the violation occurred? What is the specific allegation with regard to violation of probation?
The allegation, Your Honor, is that $47,000 of restitution is owed in this case. The defendant signed an agreement to pay it, and as of when the report was filed, only a small amount, $930, I believe, had been paid to date. And the probation period was coming to an end, so the probation officer is bringing that to the court. I think you do have to... inference from that information.
She wasn't ordered to pay it off in 2 years.
No, I don't believe... I believe the order is fairly clear that that's a separate condition. I don't believe that she was required to pay it off in 2 years, and certainly we can't assume the trial court misread its own order and had that idea in his head. The trial judge is presumed to know and follow the law, and here in interpreting his own order...
Did the major violation report allege any missed payments or failure to pay as ordered?
Other than the fact that the numbers don't add up, no, Your Honor. However, the trial judge had the benefit of that report. Indeed, he mentioned it first thing straight out. You know, here's the probation report. Have you all reviewed the sentencing guidelines? And then the hearing moved forward from there. The trial judge was obviously very familiar with the allegations in this case and was trying to craft an appropriate remedy that would allow the defendant to pay over time, to not be incarcerated, and to pay as she's able and make a dent, essentially, in the substantial
restitution. But did create burden. Another felony sentencing event.
Yes, Your Honor, and the record in this case does support that on appeal. The Commonwealth's position is that the trial judge and this court can see from this record that it fairly supports the trial court's ruling, and we're dealing with an abuse of discretion here, and in Bolden, I mean, this court has recognized multiple times that we're not bound to what parties argue below, and indeed when the court doesn't give a rationale for its reason, as the Supreme Court has recently held in that Mee Min case, it doesn't matter, it's not significant as long as the record fairly supports the trial court's conclusion, and that's what we have here. And it's unfortunate that we don't have more. However, the record that we do have is sufficient in this case.
Can I ask you, I just ask Ms. Barnes that the question I'll ask you as well. I recall, I don't see it right now, joint appendix in front of me, but I recall that there was something in the record that noted that April the 1st of 2014 was when appellant signed the agreement of what she was supposed to do. Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It's on appendix page 10 on the first page of the major violation report. It's the first sentence under adjustment to supervision.
Oh, I see it now.
And that's the date when she signed the report. We don't have, you know, there when the first payment was made thereafter. However, we are looking at a window that is slightly less. You know, the sentencing order was entered on, or the sentencing event in the first instance was March 21st. Sentencing order was entered on the 26th. And then we have the probation agreement starting April 1st. So we're looking at that period from April 1st and through. I don't think that affects the math in a way that would benefit the defendant.
Might make it 23 payments by the time of the major violation report instead of 24, right? Potentially. So the 24th might not be due until the end of March.
Yes, possibly. However, I would submit that if the probation officer was submitting a violation report, there's a violation there, and that violation would be that these payments have not been made in a timely manner. And to the extent that the probation officer is coming forward with this information, the trial court has delegated to the probation officer in this instance to supervise and monitor these restitution repayments. And if probation feels that, you know, insufficient progress has been made and violates her on that basis, that is the probation officer's prerogative in this situation.
There's nothing in the record showing the actual document that was signed by appellant and the probation officer.
No, Your Honor, it's not on the record.
How do you interpret, and I'll just ask you the question I asked Ms. Barnes, I asked both counsel, how do you interpret what I read a moment ago, a few minutes ago, on page 27 of the joint appendix? And you know what I'm referring to?
I do. I believe Ms. Barnes is probably in a better position to say what was intended by that statement. I confess that when I first read it, I read it to imply that perhaps there were prior payments that were not being made. But if you continue and you flip the page, she does note that that she's been making payments as ordered by probation.
As required for the order. Mm-hmm.
There is no assertion, however, that she's never missed a payment. You know, there's no assertion that she's done everything that she's been asked to. There's no, you know, nothing certainly to that level in this case. Although, viewing the cold record on appeal, I would have to defer to counsel's interpretation of her own statement.
Thank you.
Anything else?
I'm happy to answer further questions from the court. Again, I understand the record is small, but in this case, the record before this court does support the trial court's action, and I'd ask you to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Barnes, looks like you've got just shy of 2 minutes left.
Your Honor, just briefly, I would note that my initial statement on page 28 of the joint appendix is that I don't believe she is in violation since she is making payments as required per the order of a probation officer. That would be the allegation that she never missed a payment during that time. That was not refuted by the probation officer, by the report, by the Commonwealth. The Attorney General has mentioned that that the burden would be on the defense to prove the unreasonableness of that it wasn't unreasonable for her to make these payments. However, I would note again that this isn't a situation like in Duff where there was failure to execute the plan, because there's no evidence that she ever missed a payment or no allegation of that, and that it was conceded in the major violation report by the Commonwealth that she suffered a setback in her employment that caused the justification for the lowering of her payments. So the evidence is in the record that she was making the payments that she was able to make as based on her situation, and that therefore I don't believe that Duff is controlling here, because this isn't a situation where there was failure to execute. This is a situation where there was simply no evidence of a failure to make the plan, failure to comply with the plan, because there was no missed payments. And so I'd ask Your Honors to find that the evidence was insufficient to convict Ms. Langan of a probation violation in this case, given that the allegations were simply that when she got to the end of her two-year period, she still owed $46,000. There was no allegation that she did not make her payments as required per probation, and thus she was not in violation of any terms of her probation.
Thank you. We will come down to Greek Council and call